How should we do POVMs in general and qubits?
POVMs for qubits?
No, for qubits.
For qubits. What do you mean?
Like the Hamming rate which we have. For example, we want to do POVM on a certain Hamming rate.
Right. I mean, so there's nothing. Right. So the. So the point is, you want to find a circuit that will compute this function, the Hamming weight, say, and then store that in some qubits, and then you can measure those qubits.
Oh, so that's not a POVM, right?
Well, POVMs. So to implement, so remember, POVMs can be purified, right? So there's going to be some unitary. So here's the qubits that you want to measure. And so you add some ancilla qubits. And then you find some unitary. And then you measure. POVM, when you just think of it by itself, you don't keep any qubits around afterwards, right? The simplest version of POVM, anyway. Because you make the measurement, you get some classical result, and then the qubits are gone. But that doesn't have to be the case. So POVM can always be implemented like this, where you do this, and then you measure some qubits. Although there's an issue of, you know, if it doesn't divide exactly into qubits, but forgetting that. But you can also say, well, there's some extra qubits that I didn't measure, that I didn't need to measure to get the answer here. And I can just keep them around. Okay, and I mean, you can in the POVM formalism, you can say kind of what the evolution of the state should be. But in this way, it's much easier, because you have the unitary. And so you can just write this circuit and see what happens.
But still, this is kind of, it's a normal measurement. It's not a POVM which we kind of project in a certain direction.
Yeah, well, that's the point of, I mean, so POVM, there's not really a hard distinction between normal measurements and POVMs. So a normal von Neumann measurement, again, you know, the simplest version, you just project, you make the measurement, and then you throw away any remaining qubits. But again, that's not essential. If you're only measuring, you know, if you have 10 qubits and you only measure one of them, and if you want, you can keep around the other 9 qubits. POVM is just kind of the special case where you're making the measurement by adding in some extra ancillas. Okay? And any POVM can be implemented this way. And anything this way can be written as a POVM on the initial states. Again, if you only care about the measurement outcomes. Okay, so there's not, they're different formalisms for describing the same thing. Any other questions? Yeah.
Oh, about the homework.
Okay, which homework? The second homework. Okay.
In the very last question, do we have to use kind of quantum walk algorithms or things like that?
No. So both. I think the problem title probably was the problem title in there. Okay, the problem title I think made it clear. And in any case, I didn't intend to conceal from you. The main subroutine you're going to be using there is Grover's algorithm. Okay, so there may be a bit more to it than that. It's not just apply Grover's algorithm and you get the answer necessarily, but basically it's Grover's algorithm. Other questions? Okay. So in that case, you saw in the tutorial yesterday one application of the entropy, one place where the entropy shows up as kind of the answer to the question you're doing. And so what I wanted to start with today is another application of the entropy, specifically to the idea of compression. So data compression is a very important classical primitive. You know, if you look at a JPEG file or really any kind of movie or music or anything online, the reason you can kind of efficiently transmit it is because it's compressed. The uncompressed versions of these files are much, much bigger than the compressed versions. And that's because there's some redundancy in the information. It's not just total random. So music is not just total random noise, although, you know, depending on your taste in music, you might think it is. But nevertheless, there's a lot of regularity, right? I mean, we use notes from scales, and it's not just, you know, arbitrary frequencies that appear. It's very specific ones. And there are patterns and other kinds of redundancies that make it different from totally random information. And so compression lets you take advantage of that and send it using less information. So of course, I'm mainly going to be interested in the problem of quantum compression. But it turns out that quantum compression is almost identical to classical compression. So I'll talk about classical compression first. And so the idea here is we have, we can imagine a communication scenario. So we have two people, Alice and Bob. And Alice wants to send some data to Bob. I guess I draw this picture a lot in different variations. And the idea is, so for instance, this communication channel that Alice is using to Bob, it has some capacity. Okay, so there's a limit to how much he can send through at any given amount of time in a given amount of time. But the message she wants to send might involve more bits than the capacity of this channel for the given amount of time. So she wants to find some way to use it more efficiently. And in particular, she wants to maximize the number of bits that she can send per use of the channel. Of course, you can think about situation. Yeah.
Can you explain what is a channel?
Oh, a channel. So it's just channel is kind of the technical term for just a method of communicating from Alice to Bob. So a typical example would be like an optical fiber. So you send, you know, light through the optical fiber. Alice puts it in one end. Bob gets it on the other end, and then Bob can measure it to see, in this case, the classical message that Alice is sending. But you know, you can send through open air, so even though it's not a kind of physical channel, you just kind of send it out, it still counts as a communication channel because there's somebody on one end and somebody on the other and receiving the information. Even you know, if you take a thumb drive and carry it from one end of the room to the other and give it to somebody else, that counts as a communications channel too. Communication channel in real life, frequently they involve, as I said, light, for instance, and or you know, electromagnetic waves, and so there's some continuous variable there, and there's not a discrete use where you send something and send something and send something, but I want to think of it as a more discrete thing, just because it's simpler to talk about, and when we're sending qubits, you know, individual photons, actually there is a discrete use, right? You send one photon and then another photon and then another photon. In the classical case, you're sending lots of photons, so maybe that doesn't make sense to think about it. In the quantum case, you may actually be sending kind of at the quantum limit. So I'm gonna imagine that we have some number of uses of the channel, which is gonna be very large, and we want to maximize the number of bits or qubits that we can send on average per use of the channel. Okay, so let's think of a simple example to work with. This is a classical example, and suppose there's four possible messages. A, B, C, and D. Okay, so obviously if Alice wants to send these to Bob and she has no a priori information about which message she's going to want to send, then each time she wants to send one of these things, it's going to take 2 bits. Thank you. Okay, but suppose Jassy does have some information that some of these messages are more likely than others. So for instance, suppose that message A happens with probability 1/2, B happens with probability 1/4, and C and D both happen with probability 1/8. Okay, so now, by looking at this, Alice and Bob can, so ahead of time, Alice and Bob both know what these probabilities are. That's the simplest case. And so what they can do is they can discuss and agree on a coding scheme where Alice can send things more efficiently than just by saying each time, well, there's 4 possible messages, I'll send 2 bits to describe that. But that they don't know ahead of time exactly which messages Alice is going to want to send. And she's going to be sending lots of these, actually. So maybe the first time it's A, and the second time it's B, and the third time it's A again, and the fourth time it's D, and so on. Okay? And they don't know ahead of time what that sequence is going to be, but Bob wants to get it right. So what they can do is, in this case, there's a simple coding scheme where they use a different number of bits to send each of the 4 possible messages. So in the case of A, Alice will send the message 0. Okay? And in the case of B, Alice will send 1, 0. In the case of C, Alice will send 1, 1, 0. And in the case of D, Alice will send 1, 1, 1. Okay? And so when you look at this, you see that the most probable message is the shortest. Right, so in that case, she has to send only 1 bit. And then as the messages become less likely, the things that she sends are longer. She sends more and more bits. Okay? And the advantage of this is that on average, she's going to send fewer bits than she did without compression. So in particular, how many bits does she send per message on average? Well, half the time she sends 1 bit, and then a quarter of the time she sends 2 bits, and then, 1/8 plus 1/8 of the time she sends 3 bits, if C or D comes up. Okay? So what is this average to? Well, this is 1/2 plus 1/2 plus 3/8 plus 3/8, so that's 7/4. Which is less than 2. Okay, so on average, she saved 1/4 of a bit per message that she sends. Okay, now of course, sometimes when she gets C or D, she's actually sending more than 2 bits. But often enough, she's sending only 1 bit to make up for that, and that's how she wins out of this. Okay, so if you're only doing this once or twice, well, then it's possible, you know, and it's not that unlikely that she ends up sending more than the 2 bits per message she's supposed to. But as you go to many, many, many messages, then on average, she's going to save. Yeah?
Can't we restore data in the number of bits which we're sending? Like, if it's A, then it's only 0. If it's B, it's only 1, nothing else.
Ah, yeah. So what you're supposed to imagine here is that, again, that she's sending many, many messages in a row. Okay, and she doesn't. I mean, if she were to send this 0 and then wait before sending another one, actually, then she wouldn't be sending bits. She'd be sending trips, right? Because there's 3 possible messages she can send. She can send 0, 1, or no bit at all.
That's right.
Okay. So that's extra. That's extra information. That's not what this channel does. So you might imagine that sending that 0 is actually represented as not sending a photon, and 1 is represented as sending 1 photon. Okay. So really, I want to think there's just bits here. And so what that means is that when she's sending a stream of these things, to decode, Bob has to start at the beginning and say, oh, the first bit is a 1, so I must be in one of these messages. And the second bit is a 0. Okay, so that's a B. And then I have to start a new message. right? So if the next one is a zero, then that's A. And so you have to kind of be careful to keep track of where the current message starts. Otherwise, you're not getting this advantage, because otherwise she has to wait for these three things to before she can send another message, right? And then that's always going to be worse. Okay? Other questions? Okay. So let me point out some things about this coding scheme that I've given you. So half the time, so let's look at the first bit that Alice sends. Well, half the time it's a zero because she sends A, and half the time it's a one, which could be any of these three messages. Okay? Now let's look at the second bit that Alice sends. Well, if the first bit was zero, she's starting a new message. So again, it's going to be 50-50, zero and one. And if the first bit was one, well, then conditioned on having a B, C, or D, half the time it's going to be B, and half the time it's going to be C or D. So again, she's sending the second bit 50% zero and 50% one. And the third bit, similarly, again, if she's starting a new message, then it's 50-50. And if she's in this case where it was C or D to start with, well then again, 50% of the time she's sending a zero for the third bit, and 50% of the time she's sending a one for the third bit. So in this compression scheme, all bit strings are equally likely. Okay? That's not 100% true, because there's a variation in the number of bits she sends. But if you look at any given bit of the message that she does send, then it's 50% likely to be zero and 50% likely to be one. Okay? So this is an example of perfect compression. I just picked the numbers so that it worked out this way. And the goal here of perfect compression is that it makes all bit strings equally likely. Okay, and that's kind of the main insight about how compression works. If you were to do this, uncompressed scheme, where A was 0, 0, and B was 0, 1, C was 1, 0, and D was 1, 1, well, then what you'd see is that 0 for the first bit is much more likely than 1 for the first bit, right? Because A and B are much more likely together than C and D. Happens, so three quarters of the time you get a 0, and one quarter of the time you get a 1 for the first bit. Okay, and that's not using all the messages efficiently. What we want is this, that all the bit strings are equally likely. And so we've kind of combined messages to make that true. Okay? Does that make some sense? Are there questions on that? Okay, so that gives us an insight as to how we can design more general compression schemes. So this particular one, it was pretty simple. We just took one message and we had a way of encoding it. But in general, it's simpler to talk about the general case when instead of taking messages one by one, Alice waits until she has a whole bunch of them that she wants to send, and then finds an encoding scheme that encodes this long list of messages altogether. So that's called block coding, block compression. And so the idea is, like I said, Alice collects many messages from the same source. And then, some sequences of messages will be pretty likely. Some sequences of messages will be very unlikely. So for instance, the message that consists of only the string of messages that consists of only C and D above, that's really unlikely to happen. Okay? Of course, any given message is sequence of messages is itself pretty unlikely. But there's some types of messages that are much more likely, right? And a message, and kind of the typical case in the example that I gave, we'll have about half the messages being A's, and a quarter of them being B's, and an eighth being C's, and an eighth being D's, right? And so what she's going to do is she's going to decide, well, in conjunction with Bob, decide on an efficient coding scheme for typical messages. Okay. And then for the atypical messages, the ones that are very far from the typical distribution, she has a choice. She can either just give up in those cases, and not send anything, or she can send something that's longer than she expects, or doesn't give the right answer, or something like that. And the thing is that once you've collected many, many messages, atypical messages are very unlikely. Okay. So in particular, suppose more generally that the source, so this is the thing that decides what messages Alice wants to send. Outputs message I with probability PI. So right now I'm imagining that Alice has some sort of black box, which is producing messages that it wants Alice to send to Bob. Of course, you could be getting these messages from anywhere, right? It could be, like I said, it could be some picture or a series of pictures that she wants to send, and they could then these messages might be pixels in those pictures. It could be anything. Okay, but this is kind of again kind of a black box model that lets you plug in any kind of application and use it. So anyway, so she has these messages with probability PI, and this example. This kind of this simplest example of compression, each message is generated independently of the previous one. So they're all independently random. And of course, in real life, that doesn't have to be true. And that's another complication for practical applications of compression. But we won't worry about that. So we'll assume the independent source. So then the typical case when we have n messages is going to be, we'll have ni I messages, and ni will be roughly pi times n, right? And while, of course, it won't be exactly pi times n, it'll be just close to pi times n, the difference from pi times n will be about square root of n. So the odds are that ni over n is, as n gets large, ni over n is going to get very close to pi. And that's the effect that makes block compression work. So in particular, let's take advantage of these and count how many typical messages there are. Well, so any particular sequence of messages contains NII messages. And so the product of a particular sequence, well, the first one might be message 3, and the second one might be message 2, and the third one might be message 7. And so then it would be P3 times P2 times P7, dot, dot, dot. And what we're going to do is we're going to get factors of pi for each of the I messages that show up. This is the ordered sequence, right? So one particular typical sequence has a probability product over I of pi to the ni. Okay? And then how many typical sequences are there? That's kind of a standard combinatorial thing. If there were just two messages, right, and then it would be n choose n1. But since there's many possible messages, the number of typical sequences is n factorial over the product over I and I factorial. Why is that? Well, so if you take a particular sequence, there's n factorial ways to rearrange it, right? But anything that rearranges the one messages between them, that doesn't change it. And anything that rearranges the two messages between them, that doesn't change it. And so there's n1 factorial ways of rearranging the n1 messages, and n2 factorial ways of rearranging the n2 messages, and so on. Okay. So then what that means is that the total probability of getting a typical sequence What am I doing here? Yeah, so I don't need to calculate the total probability. I just want to calculate the number of typical sequences. So this is actually irrelevant. This is the calculation you need to do to figure out that this is true. But you already knew that was true. So. So this number of typical sequences, n factorial over the product over ni factorial. And yeah.
So why are you worried about the order of your message?
So Bob wants to decode not just the right messages, but the right sequence of messages. Okay. And if you think about that, that's kind of obvious that's what he should want, because if you imagine, you know, encoding a picture as a sequence of pixels, let's just say, forget, you know, colors or anything like that. Let's just say the pixels are black and white, right? The order of black and white really, really matters there. And it's not enough just to know how many blacks and how many whites. So Bob wants to decode the actual sequence of messages. And so we have the typical sequence that has about ni is about pi times n. And so this is n factorial over the product over I of pi n factorial. And roughly. And so you already saw for the entanglement concentration problem in the tutorial that in the special case where there's only two things, that this is about 2 to the entropy. And for the same mathematical reasons, this thing is about 2 to some entropy, 2 to the nh of pi. And h of pi here is called the Shannon entropy. And the formula is basically just the classical version of the von Neumann entropy, which is minus sum over I pi log base 2 of pi. Okay, and of course the Shannon entropy, remember, looks like this. The von Neumann entropy. S of rho is minus trace rho log rho. Okay, and so if you take a diagonal density matrix, then the trace is just the sum over the diagonal terms. Diagonal terms are pi. You get this formula. Okay, so this is the quantum version of this. Okay. Yeah. This is the 2. And the 2 down here and the 2 here are the same, of course. But we like to write it this way because this tells us how many bits we need. Okay? And so what this tells us is that what we can do is we can compress this sequence by saying, well, we're going to use use this many bits, n h of pi. And we use that many bits. And we're going to just list all the typical sequences. And we'll say, well, the first typical sequence is going to be all zeros. And the second typical sequence will be 00001, and so on. Okay. And if we get some non-typical, if Alice happens to get some non-typical sequence, or something that's, so, yeah, if she happens to get some non-typical sequence, something that's very far from this distribution, then she'll just send one of these things. And Bob will decode it and he'll get it wrong, but the probability of that happening is exponentially unlikely with n. And so what that gives us is one of the major theorems of classical information theory, which is Shannon's source coding theorem. And what the source coding theorem says is so suppose we have some protocol . So there's two sides of it. So one is the existence side that says there exists a scheme, which I've more or less just told you, to compress. And the other one says that that's the best you can do. So suppose we have a protocol to encode n messages from a source with entropy h. And we insist that the probability of failure, that is, of Bob decoding the wrong message, goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. So then it follows that the scheme uses at least nh bits plus maybe some small additional terms. So this little o notation is like the big O notation, except that it means strictly less than order n. So that the scheme uses nh plus little o of n bits. And furthermore, there exists a protocol that achieves that. Okay. So what that's telling you is that the scheme that I've told you is basically the best you can do, at least in terms of efficiency in sending information. And the roughly speaking, the reason behind that is because, well, we've we've found the compression scheme that encodes all the typical sequences. And the typical sequences have about the same probability, right? They all have that probability up there. And while you can leave out one or two of the typical sequences, and that's not very likely that that particular typical sequence will show up, if you start to leave out a significant fraction of them, then there's a good probability that one of those, one of the ones in the set that you've left out, will in fact show up. But to use fewer than n h bits, you'll have to leave out a significant fraction of them. Because if you don't, then you have this many typical sequences that you have to encode, basically. That's not a proof, obviously. The proof of this is more complicated. But hopefully it gives you the intuition of why this is the best you can do. Okay? So are there questions on that? Okay. So in that case, maybe let's move on to quantum compression. I've already used up a large fraction of my time talking about classical compression. But like I said, quantum compression is very similar. So quantum compression is called Schumacher compression. It was invented by Ben Schumacher. And Schumacher compression works on basically the same idea. So in this case, we have a source that outputs quantum states. And let's say it will output the state psi I with probability pi. So what we can do is we can summarize the source. So classically, we like to summarize the source as a probability distribution, right? Pi for probability I, that's a probability distribution. Probability pi of having a quantum state, psi I, well, that's a density matrix. And so the density matrix is just sum over I, pi, psi I. OK? And then an optimal compression algorithm for this is, well, kind of the simplest thing you might think of doing, which is to say, Alice can diagonalize rho, and then in that basis, she just performs classical compression. Classical block coding, say. Okay? And how many bits is that going to take? Well, remember I said that if rho is diagonal, the Shannon entropy just reduces to the von Neumann entropy just reduces to the Shannon entropy. Okay, so what she'll do is she'll take the Shannon entropy in that basis. But you know, if you don't know ahead of time or you don't care to calculate what that basis is, well, the it's just going to be equal to the von Neumann entropy. So this uses S of rho times n qubits. Of course, she has to send qubits rather than classical bits, even though she's diagonalized it. Because Bob doesn't know what the diagonal basis is. No, that's not true. Bob does know what the diagonal basis is. But Bob wants to receive quantum bits rather than classical bits. And in particular, we're not going to insist, actually, that Bob has the right density matrix for each state. We're going to insist on something more stringent. So in particular, we're going to imagine a case where Alice is not getting pure states. But she gets entangled states. With some reference system R. Okay. And this case where she might even there might only be one entangled state that she gets every time. Partially entangled state, say. And then she has again she has a density matrix for her source. And she can treat it the same way and compress. And then so she sends the state to Bob. And then if Bob were later to get together with that reference system, we insist that this should be the same state. So in particular, Bob's output with the reference system, so BR, should have high fidelity. With the input state AR. So fidelity should go to 1 with AR as n goes to infinity. OK? Does that make sense? And to achieve this, she'll definitely have to send qubits. Alice will definitely have to send qubits to Bob. Because if you send classical bits, then any entanglement with a reference system would end up being destroyed. There are questions on this? Yeah, that's right. So that's like what we talked about yesterday. That's right. So in that case, the entropy is the entanglement, but it's also the amount of compression you can get, or you know, related to the amount of compression you can get. So this is a case where it's kind of serving double duty. And another way to think about it is that's one way, another one beyond the entanglement concentration application, that you can see that entropy is a good measure of entanglement because it's actually corresponding to you know some operational quantity that you can do with this entanglement. Yeah.
We have to assume that the total state of Alice and the reference is pure.
Well, the total state doesn't have to be pure. So if it's not pure, you could imagine that there was you know another reference system, and you'll even be preserving fidelity that purifies the state, and you'll even be preserving fidelity between Bob R and this other reference system. Okay, and so certainly if you throw away the extra reference system, the fidelity will be better, right? Because throwing away a subsystem, that's a possible CP map, and fidelity can only increase under CP maps. So fidelity without the extra reference system is at least as good as fidelity with it. So that's really what this reference system is. So normally you think about it as being pure, simply because that's the hardest case to satisfy. And since compression gets that right, Schumacher compression gets that right, it'll get every other case right too. OK? Other questions? Right. Okay. So good. Let's imagine that we'll just work in the standard basis. Okay. And so let's say that we're doing well. That's maybe a bad example because of the variable length coding. But we have some sort of classical thing. From Alice's point of view, it's diagonal, so it just looks kind of classical. Where with probability p1, she sends message 1. Probability p2, she sends message 2, and so on. But actually, it's not really classical. It's actually part of some entangled state. And so she has, between A and R, you have sum over I of PIII, something like that. So now let's think what the classical coding scheme will do. The classical coding scheme will say the typical case where when we expand the tensor product of n of these states, the typical case has the highest amplitude and also the highest probability of having about pi of the messages being I, so pi of the qubits. And the point is that if you expand that big superposition, this is basically what you did. Well, it's not quite the same as what you did for entanglement concentration. But the kind of the most likely case has a typical sequence as in the cats. And the unlikely cases have atypical sequences. And so this coding scheme gives the right decoding for the typical sequences and maybe the wrong thing for the atypical sequences. Okay? So the fidelity, well, in this case, we're just taking fidelity of pure state, so it's just the absolute value of the inner product. But the fidelity is going to be dominated by the typical cases that have high amplitude. Right? And we know the overall probability of that happening is very close to 1. And so, in fact, the fidelity will be very close to 1. Now, if you just do this one time, then you know there's a probability of getting the unlikely messages. And then the fidelity won't be very good, because the unlikely messages won't be decoded right. But once you do it many, many times, the amplitude, just like the probability, gets exponentially close to 1. Okay, it's a little bit hand-wavy in there, I know, but hopefully you kind of see. If you go back to the entanglement concentration problem and try do the same calculation here, you'll see probably how it works.
So what's an example?
Yeah. So, I mean, so the reference system is kind of a hypothetical construct that's used to evaluate how good the protocol is. But in general, you know, Alice might have some quantum computer, and she does some calculation, and she gets some qubits, and some of those qubits she wants to keep for herself, and some of them she wants to send on to Bob. Okay, and I don't know, let's say she's done the same calculation many times, so she has many, many such messages that she wants to send to Bob. And so what she can do is she can compress them and send them this way. And then Alice and Bob will have some entangled state. And they want to get some entangled state because there might be some quantum correlations between these cases between the qubits that she kept and the qubits she sent that they care about. Okay, so that's an example where the reference system is now held by Alice. But you can imagine other more complicated situations where some quantum network and people are sending information back and forth.
So Bob doesn't have to have access to the reference
system. No. But so to decode, I mean, the classical block coding protocol doesn't need Bob to know anything about the reference system or what messages were sent or anything like that. He only needs to know the distribution. And actually, you can kind of even get past that. The reference system is only used to evaluate whether the protocol really succeeded or not, whether it's a good protocol or not, I should say. Okay, but you know they designed the protocol from the beginning to be a good protocol, so that's why the reference system is only needed in this theoretical sense. Now, if it's not there at all, if there is no reference system, then there's no real way to test whether Bob has received the right message or not, right sequence of messages or not. So in that case, maybe it doesn't really matter what they do. But the assumption is that somewhere out there is some information, which could be quantum information that's entangled with the state, about the thing that Bob is supposed to receive. And this is our way of saying whether he did or not. OK? Other questions? Okay, so in that case, let me move on to a slightly different topic. I'm not going to have time to go into this one in very much depth, and it's actually can be a pretty complicated topic. But I want to at least introduce you to some of the concepts that people have discussed. And so this topic is mixed state entanglement. So yesterday we discussed pure state entanglement and had the entropy there. Mixed state entanglement, unfortunately, is a lot more complicated. And there's many different possible ways you can quantify it. And it's not really clear that one of these is better than the others. You don't have anything like entanglement concentration or compression to pick out the best measures of mixed state entanglement. But you can still come up with things that are kind of sensible. So one thing that people have discussed a lot is called the entanglement of formation. So again, we're going to be in the bipartite case. And entanglement of formation says, well, let's start with some number of EPR pairs. And then we'll try to make the state psi. Mixed state. Make the density matrix rho AB with as few EPR pairs as possible. Okay, so that's something you can define. So in other words, the entanglement of formation EF of rho AB is equal to the minimum PI psi I of sum over I PI. And then the entanglement of psi. Okay. So what is? How does this work? Well, why does this formula correspond to that definition? Well, what you can do is one possible way you can try to make rho AB. So I should say make it using LOCC. So one thing you can try to do to make rho AB is say, well, I'll take some decomposition of rho AB into pure states, write it as a mixture of pure states. So it's sum of PI, psi I, psi I. And each psi I is an entangled state. Okay, and so I'll have to use EPR pairs to make psi I. And it turns out that kind of through the opposite version of entanglement concentration, you can, on average, make psi I using S of trace B psi I psi I. So this is the entanglement of the state psi I. And so using that many EPR pairs, you can make psi I on average. And so what it's saying is that with probability PI, I had to use this many EPR pairs to make the state psi I. And that's something you can do with LOCC, because Alice can say, I'm going to generate a random number that outputs I with probability PI. If I get I, we'll create that state psi I. And that gives us the correct mixture over the states. Okay. So this is certainly something you can achieve. And if you think about it some more, you'll see that this is actually the best thing you can do, except that there's not a unique decomposition of rho into a mixture of pure states. So you have to take the minimum, you have to take the best possible decomposition into pure states. Okay? And that gives you the entanglement of formation. So what about the case where they don't need any EPR pairs to create the state? So when we don't need any EPR pairs, then what that means is that we have some decomposition where this is always zero, right? And this is zero when psi I is a tensor product state. And so that's a notion called separable. So we say a state is separable if there exists a decomposition and the decomposition is going to be a tensor product. Each state in the decomposition is a tensor product. So it's just this. Okay. So this is saying rho is a mixture of tensor product states. Of course, there might be some other decomposition which this is not true. Okay. So separable just says there exists a decomposition this way. So this is really the notion from mixed states of what it means to be unentangled. Because this notion is that a separable state can have classical correlations, but what it's not going to do is not going to have some sort of quantum correlation. It's not going to have entangled state. And so a separable state, based on this argument, can be created using no entanglement at all. It can just be created using LOCC, right? Because Alice will say, I'll generate I with probability pi, I'll send I to Bob, and then I will create the state psi I, Bob will create the state phi I. That gives them the right state. Okay. Whereas states that involve some entanglement of formation are not separable. Okay. So that was one of the conditions we needed to have an entanglement monotone. That states which are unentangled have zero value, and states that are entangled have a non-zero value. And while it's yeah okay so. Entanglement of formation is, in fact, an entanglement monotone. So what were the conditions? One was that it's zero for separable states, unentangled states, and non-zero otherwise. What was the second condition? Second condition was that it was invariant under unitaries. But why is that true? Well, if you do local unitaries, under local unitaries, if you do local unitaries on the state rho AB, well, that will change the state rho, but you can just compensate for that by taking the decompositions and performing the same unitaries on them. Right, and because the entropy is invariant under local unitaries, so will the entanglement of formation be. Right? And then the third thing is that it's non-increasing under LOCC. And that's kind of obvious in this case, because non-increasing. So suppose you could take the state rho AB and do some LOCC operation that would give you rho prime AB that had a bigger entanglement of formation. Well, that's a contradiction, because then you could create the state rho prime AB by using this procedure to make rho AB, and then doing this LOCC procedure to make rho prime. Okay? And the total amount of entanglement you used there was just the amount of entanglement used to make rho AB, because the second step didn't involve any more entanglement. It's LOCC. Okay? So that means that the entanglement formation can't increase under LOCC, and that's what makes an entanglement monotone. Okay? But there's one rather bad thing about entanglement of formation, which is that it's something called superadditive. So what does that mean? Well, so if you imagine the situation where you have two states, rho AB and rho prime AB, and you want to make them both, well, this is backwards. It could be subadditive, I guess. Right, subadditive. So one way to make this is to make the state rho AB and make the state rho prime AB and then just, you know, take them both. Okay? And so to doing that, we'll use entanglement that's equal to the amount to make rho AB plus the amount of entanglement needed to make rho prime AB. But it's possible that it's cheaper to make these two states together than it is separately. Okay? And it turns out there are cases where it actually is cheaper. And so that's a bit annoying. It means that, for instance, that it's cheaper to make entangled states when you're making them in bulk rather than if you're doing them one at a time, you get a discount. And the problem is that means that this is maybe not the right notion of entanglement for a state, because how much entanglement it actually creates to make the state depends on the context in which you're doing it. Right? That if you're doing it alone, it costs one amount. If you're doing it along with some other states, it might cost less. So one thing we like to look at then is to compensate for this is look at something called the regularized entanglement of formation, also known as the entanglement cost. And so the entanglement cost of the state rho AB is the limit as n goes to infinity of 1 over n times the entanglement of formation of n copies of the state. Okay? So this is a case where you're really buying in huge quantities, and you want to know how much entanglement per state you need in this asymptotic limit. So that's a slightly better thing. It doesn't have this subadditivity problem, although it does still have the possibility that when combining with some other totally different kind of state, you could get some other discount. It has some other issues, namely that because it involves this limit as n goes to infinity, it's not something you can compute, or at least not something we know how to compute, I should say. So that's kind of annoying. I mean, even the entanglement of formation is not that easy to compute because it involves a maximization over all possible decomposition. But the entanglement cost, well, we have no idea. So that's kind of one big open area of research, is dealing with this subadditivity. I mean, until recently, people thought this was additive, but a few years ago, we found it's not. And then, of course, the other complication is that this is just one measure of mixed state entanglement. And it's for this specific task of how much entanglement you need to make the state, that seems like the right thing. But there's other questions you can ask instead. Like, well, I have this state. How much entanglement, pure state entanglement, EPR pairs, how much can I get out of it? And that turns out to be a sensible quantity, too, called the distillable entanglement. I'm probably not going to have time to talk about it in this class, but it turns out that distillable entanglement is related to the notion of quantum error correction, which is what we're going to be doing for the next few days. And distillable entanglement is also not something that we really know how to compute. It has, it rather than being subadditive, it's super additive. And so it has the same n goes to infinity problem. And so we have here two physically sensible measures of entanglement that we don't know how to compute. And they're different, in fact. But because they're hard to compute, people, you know, sometimes like to come up with other measures that are maybe easier to compute. And people have done that. sometimes they're better, sometimes they're worse. In any case, it's all a very bewildering mess once you start to go into literature to try to figure this stuff out. But this at least should give you a taste for the types of problems that people worry about. Okay, so there are questions on this. Yeah?
So does it mean that a state which is density the matrix is a tensor product of density matrices of the two subsystems is not necessarily or
so if the density matrix is a tensor product,
yeah,
then that's definitely separable. Right? Because you can just take a decomposition of the first of the density matrix on the left on Alice's side and the density matrix on Bob's side, and that will immediately give you a decomposition that works this way. But it's also true that you can have separable states that are not of that form. Yeah.
That's density matrix. If the phi I can correspond to different eigenstates of a different physical observables eigenstates, is this still separable?
Yeah. So this is not really making any statement about what the physical observables are or anything like that. I mean, people have talked a bit about some sort of variations of the notion of entanglement in the presence of super selection rules. Like so in principle, I mean, these states, you know, they could have superpositions of different values of charge or, you know, different energies or any kind of physical quantity. But if you want to put some more restrictions on and say, well, superpositions of charge, that's not allowed. We never see that in the real world. Then that puts limits on what unitaries you can do. Instead of doing LOCC, you have to do local operations that don't change the charge, for instance. And in that context, it's kind of a similar picture, but the details change. But for now, we're just talking in a totally abstract case. You can do any unitary, any local unitary. The only kind of physical quantity that's here is locality. That Alice is here, Bob is here, and they have to do things separately. So okay, I'm almost done. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, then we'll let Freddie take over.